opportunity for young men to engage in competition and risk-taking is a bad idea and likely to lead to unpleasant blowback. Young men feel millions of years of evolutionary pressure emanating from their testicles, pushing them toward risk and competition. For this reason, the best bet is not to eliminate risk entirely, but to replace truly dangerous risk and conflict with more benign opportunities for thrill-seeking and competition. Sports in which you can't get hurt at all are unlikely to fulfill such goals, but sports in which you won't get hurt too badly are a great substitute. Cooperation and competition. As I discuss in Chapter 1, our enhanced capacity for cooperation was the key adaptation that allowed our ancestors to survive the move from the trees. Because we evolved to cooperate with one another, we also evolved a cheater detection system and a strong emotional response to free riders. We all know the feelings of anger and righteous indignation when others take advantage of us. This evolved response explains why one of the continuing arguments surrounding our welfare system is whether recipients are lazy people making suckers of the rest of us, or disadvantaged people who deserve our sympathy and help. Our outrage and anger when we are cheated ensure that others in our group cooperate with us. But our emotions have also been shaped by the underlying cooperation goal itself. We don't really like people who cooperate with us only to reciprocate our earlier help, or to gain our later cooperation in return. Rather, we like people who are friendly, kind, and generous, who enjoy cooperating for cooperation's sake. That, of course, means that other people like, or dislike, us for the same reasons, which gave a substantial evolutionary advantage to our ancestors who genuinely enjoyed cooperating. This is why we often share resources with strangers who will never be able to help us in return. Economists are sometimes surprised when people share with strangers, but this surprise emerges from a misunderstanding of our evolutionary history. It may seem that we're setting ourselves up to be suckers, but even though generous people do get exploited, in the long run, they win far more than they lose. Generous people are more popular than stingy or calculating people all over the world. When Hadza hunter-gatherers in Tanzania break camp and go off in different directions, the generous ones have lots of people who want to be with them, while the stingy ones are at constant risk of being left alone. When the Martu people of Western Australia head off on morning hunts, the generous people are always chosen as partners, even if they're not the best hunters, while the stingy ones are often forgotten and left behind. The same effects hold among the Quechua pastoralists in the Peruvian Andes and every other people on Earth for whom we have the necessary data. When I reflect on the many times my friends have helped me out over the years, I see that nothing has meant more to me or stuck with me more than when their generosity was completely uncalculated. For example, I remember visiting my friend Sid in college and accidentally spending all my money before I'd found a way to get home. When I asked Sid, who was perennially broke, if he could help pay for a ticket, he jammed his hand in his pocket and handed over all the cash he had. He made no effort to count it, had no clue how much it was, and wasn't interested in finding out. As a consequence of these evolutionary pressures, we evolved to be mindlessly helpful, automatic cooperators. We cooperate without thinking, because cooperation is our default reaction when people need our help. When people participate in experiments in which they must choose whether to cooperate with others or defect, cooperation is chosen more quickly than defection, even if the sensible choice is to defect. The same effect emerges when people are forced to make snap decisions. They're far more likely to choose cooperation. I remember being delighted when this research on mindless helpfulness was first published, as it explained my completely idiotic behavior when I risked a child's life for a 40-cent ice cream cone. About a dozen years ago, I was riding down an escalator with my wife and two small children while carrying a McDonald's ice cream cone that I had just purchased for them. As we started the ride down, I heard a woman screaming at the bottom. When I looked toward her, I saw the hands of a small child gripping onto the handrail of the upward escalator, but the child himself was out of view. I realized that he was riding up on the outside of the escalator, and had apparently been carried too far up and was now afraid to drop off. This was a major problem, as the top of the escalator was two stories high, and three-quarters of the way up there was a decorative pole abutting the escalator that would soon dislodge the boy from his rather tenuous hold. It was an easy matter to jump over the handrail to the other escalator, so I ran down and reached the little boy a few yards before he got to the pole. He weighed almost nothing, and I easily picked him up by his arms from the far side of the escalator. But here's the stupid part. I risked gumming up the whole operation by virtue of the fact that I was on autopilot, in a mindlessly helpful state. As I ran down the escalator, rather than chucking my ice cream to the ground below or dropping it on the escalator, I transferred it to my pinky finger so I could continue to hold it while I reached over the handrail to grab the boy's arms. I'm sure that this process slowed me down a bit, and I'm also sure that it was harder to grab him while I was simultaneously trying to avoid dropping my ice cream. The ice cream also nearly got me punched in the face, as by now the boy's father had heard his wife screaming and saw me riding the escalator away from her, holding their small child, and carrying an ice cream cone. I can only imagine what was running through his mind, but thankfully, he decided to withhold judgment and simply ran down the escalator and grabbed his child from me. When the rush of the event was over, I sat there looking at the ice cream cone in my hand and wondering how I could have been so stupid. In retrospect, my effort to help the little boy was clearly conducted on autopilot. Without the cognitive wherewithal to weigh the costs and benefits of holding on to the ice cream cone, I automatically followed the standard rules of politeness not to throw food on the ground. Indeed, cases of helping gone awry are so common that many countries, and U.S. states, have adopted Good Samaritan laws, which protect would-be helpers from lawsuits if they make matters worse. For example, how would I have explained myself to a jury who wanted to know why I had let the child fall instead of the ice cream cone? The desire to cooperate is a powerful force, and the outcome of these evolutionary pressures is a motivational system that is highly attuned to helping others. We want the grandkids to come over for Sunday lunch, and we gain genuine satisfaction from helping family and friends. In a recent World Values survey of nearly 100 countries, people around the world rated family as the single most important thing in their lives, and this makes perfect evolutionary sense. But the altruistic satisfaction we gain from cooperating extends beyond kin and even close friends to our entire community. As I discuss in Chapter 3, our communities are much larger now than the ones in which we originally evolved, but the psychological principles that link us to our community have the same effects they've always had. In that sense, we haven't changed in any fundamental way from our hunter-gatherer selves. Integration with our community was and is one of the keys to living the good life. Unfortunately, as we've become wealthier and more reliant on technology, we've simultaneously reduced our reliance on one another, and thereby unintentionally disrupted our integration with our neighbors and larger community. Some people find it easy to enmesh themselves into new communities, and thus frequent moves don't impinge on their life satisfaction. Extroverts are such people, as they enjoy the company of others whom they don't know well, and view getting to know people as an opportunity. Introverts, in contrast, find meeting lots of new people difficult and unpleasant, so moving to a new neighborhood, city, or state has a major impact on their life satisfaction. Integration with one's community is important to everyone's life satisfaction, but how this is best achieved differs among people. For extroverts, pulling up stakes and heading across the country or around the world is of lesser consequence. For introverts, there will be a price to pay for frequent life moves, and career or schooling opportunities in new communities must be considered carefully in light of their offsetting costs. It's important to keep in mind that offsetting costs are not just temporary feelings of unhappiness. As we discuss in the last chapter, happiness is the body's cue to allow the immune system to function at peak efficiency, and frequent unhappiness has long-term health costs. The importance of community integration for health can be found in research by Shigehiro Oishi and Ulrich Schimach. They found that frequent residential moves in childhood lead to accumulating damages to the health of introverts. Even though the damage occurs in childhood, the data suggests that they never fully recover. Introverts who moved frequently during childhood suffer greater late-life mortality, while extroverts are unaffected by childhood moves. These data reflect the costs of breaking connections with our community. But of course, most people are focused on creating and sustaining such connections. Life satisfaction is achieved by being embedded in your community and by supporting community members who are in need. This explains why the same people who adamantly oppose welfare are often incredibly generous in supporting downtrodden members of their own communities. When they are assured that the need is genuine and that they are not being taken for a ride, people of all political stripes endeavor to help their fellow humans. Charity supports those in need, but feeling you have made a contribution to your community is the more important manifestation of this effect. We need to be of value to our community. Our ancestors who were not of value were at risk of ostracism and hence death. And the most obvious way to be of value is to produce more than you cost. This calculus may not be conscious, but it drives us to be contributing members of society. When someone asks how you'd like to be remembered after you're gone, what they are really asking about is the nature of your contribution to your community. Happiness and learning. As I've mentioned throughout this book, humans actively learn most of what we need to know to survive and thrive. We're born knowing very little, with a brain that is really only half-baked, but that would be too large to birth if we waited for it to be fully cooked. As a consequence, we have an inordinately long period of development before we can become viable, contributing members of our community. Unlike baby wildebeests, which can run from predators soon after they're born, we're pretty much anyone's potential snack for over a decade. Our long period of development is consumed almost entirely by learning the means of survival used by our group. As discussed in Chapter 2, our flexibility has enabled us to colonize the entire planet. But our flexibility also means that there is no way we can rely on inborn knowledge or instinct to survive. As a consequence, evolution has ensured that learning is tightly linked to our motivational system. Humans all over the world love to learn. Curiosity is one of our fundamental drives, and the satisfaction associated with learning and mastering something new is universal. The motivational importance of curiosity is widely understood, but there are two important forms of learning, and therefore two important sources of life satisfaction, that people often fail to recognize: play and storytelling. Play is universal in humans, just as it is among our mammalian cousins. Play is most common in animals before they reach maturity, because it is a form of learning the rules and strategies of adult life. Play also helps humans and other animals learn to cooperate, as their early interactions with one another are positive and teach them who reciprocates and who does not. Play provides opportunities for young males to learn to compete for females. It teaches strategies for eventually rising in the adult hierarchy, and it helps juveniles learn to hunt prey and escape predators. Kittens like nothing better than to pounce on one another in mock battles. Little boys enjoy this as well, and all human children engage in endless hours of pretend play, sport, and games. Because humans are unique in the extraordinary amount of information they must learn, the importance of play has extended beyond our childhood and into our adult lives. In the absence of play, life is a lot less fun. The importance of play is common to all mammals and the occasional bird and reptile, but storytelling is unique to humans. A major advantage of human learning is that our incredible communicative abilities enable us to incorporate the learning and accomplishments of others into our understanding of the world. The oldest and most important form of this type of learning is our rich oral tradition. Storytelling can be found in all human cultures, and surely began when our hunter-gatherer ancestors sat around the fire at the end of the day and regaled each other with tales of their experiences. Storytelling around the fire is still an important activity in hunter-gatherer communities. It's a time when the immediate economic and social concerns of the day are put aside, and people focus on the broader patterns, rules, and lessons for achieving a productive life in their community. Good storytellers gained status in their group because they were valued for the entertainment and learning they provided. In our world, these roles are occupied by comedians, talk show hosts, filmmakers, ministers, imams, rabbis, authors, academics, and political pundits who entertain, inform, and transmit social norms to their listeners. Everyone evolved a proclivity to enjoy listening to stories, as hearing about the trials and tribulations of others provides a risk-free way to learn the difficult and sometimes expensive lessons garnered from their experiences. Finally, storytelling connected community members to each other through shared emotional experiences, a sense of shared reality, and a common knowledge of how to approach the world. When I tell my story about accidentally peeing in the sink at a Springsteen concert, and listeners share my embarrassment and laughter, I feel validated, and my connection to my social group is a little bit stronger. When I listen to the wonderful, outrageous, or scary stories of my friends and discover how they turned out, I learn what to do if I ever find myself in similar circumstances. For these reasons, listening to and telling stories are two important sources of happiness and life satisfaction. Happiness, personality, and development. As I suggest earlier in this chapter, there is more than one way to be a successful human, and hence more than one route to happiness. If I'm big and strong, I might attract a mate through sports or other physical competitions, but if I'm small and weak, I'd be better off using my humor or kindness. Such differences in brawn, brains, and personality can also make me suited to different types of careers. People tend to choose a strategy of best fit by pursuing activities that rely on their strengths and avoid their weaknesses. Because our motivational system is attuned to our potential for success and the degree to which our group values us, different activities make different people happy. If I'm better at art than athletics, I'll probably find greater satisfaction from painting than from playing football. These individual differences, in turn, also fluctuate over the course of our lifespan. When we are children, it's very difficult to contribute to our group, and hence children gain most of their happiness from their activities with one another and from acceptance by their parents and peers. Because their unique features are more likely to be noticed by others than their common ones, their sense of self becomes tied to the ways they can differentiate themselves positively in their group. Even in childhood, people start to focus on and develop the unique talents that will make them most productive when they reach adulthood. But, of course, their childlike worldview will often take them in odd directions. I remember when my daughter learned to read by listening in while I was helping her older brother with his homework, and I tried to get her to brag about it to her preschool teacher. "What did you learn to do yesterday?" I asked her when we sat down with her teacher. She looked puzzled for a moment, and then brightened up and announced, "I learned to slide down the fire pole." As this example reveals, positive distinctiveness is not always achieved by children in a manner that reflects adult priorities. Once we reach adulthood, our contribution to the community becomes important, and we start to rely on the skills we've learned in an effort to rise in the hierarchy and be valued by members of our group. These skills are relatively stable in most people throughout young and middle adulthood, but they begin to show notable changes in late life. At that point, physical skills typically decline. Offsetting their deteriorating physical skills, older adults tend to have a larger body of knowledge, which made them valuable in our ancestral past. Unfortunately, in our modern and rapidly changing world, the knowledge of older adults can become obsolete. But the evolutionary pressures that push us to contribute to our group don't change just because we have gotten older, and many older adults strive to find ways to make a positive impact on their community. Issues of legacy and care for others become increasingly important among older adults, as these are often their greatest opportunities to remain connected and helpful to their community. In our quest for the good life, we should remember that sitting back and putting our feet up may sound great, but retirement is likely to be more satisfying if we can also find a way to make a contribution to others. when we're overwhelmed by work and other commitments and have no time for ourselves, a permanent vacation sounds like a great idea. But don't be fooled by retirement brochures that promote only leisure activities. For most of us, that's not as good as it sounds. Pitfalls of a modern world. Pondering the good life may be a uniquely modern pastime, but the ways we achieve it are by following the ancient strategies that made our ancestors successful. Sex and food, parenthood and play, mastery and storytelling, friendship and kin, hearth and home, community and contribution. These were the keys to success in our past, and they remain the keys to our happiness today. Nonetheless, our modern world provides many new opportunities for happiness, and it is not always clear when the modern version is just as good as the original. For example, movies and television have replaced many aspects of storytelling, and both are a lot of fun. But storytelling is much more than just relating a series of events, and movies and television don't connect people to each other in the same way that conversations do. Unless we talk about them later, of course. To some degree, movies and television are thus a phenotypic indulgence, like potato chips. So it is no surprise that people rarely cite television programs as an important source of life satisfaction, no matter how much they love their favorite show. Anecdotal evidence suggests that books might be more likely than TV to have an important and lasting effect on us. If that is true, a critical part of storytelling may be the imaginative and generative processes taking place in our minds when someone else tells a tale that we cannot directly experience. But even books are typically less memorable and important than the stories we tell and are told, because reading is typically done alone. Other aspects of our modern world that mimic important ancestral experiences provide much thinner gruel and leave us a lot less satisfied. Drugs and alcohol are probably the most notable examples of phenotypic indulgences, as they go straight to the brain regions responsible for pleasure without providing the physical or experiential basis from which that pleasure was meant to emanate. After drugs and alcohol, junk food comes in a close second, as the sugar, fat, and salt that our ancestors desperately sought in the past are overabundant today. Sadly, our struggle is now against what was once a healthy goal, to eat as much sugar, fat, and salt as possible. The price we pay when we have too much of a good thing brings us to the final lesson I want to highlight from our evolutionary history. Long-term sexual relationships were our ancestors' best recipe for raising successful offspring, and as a result, we find long-term relationships particularly rewarding. When we partner with the right person, we have our best shot at a lasting increase in happiness. But evolution also gave us a preference for novel partners, as both men and women gain reproductive benefits when they put their genetic eggs into more than one basket. The problem is that novel partners were relatively rare in our ancestral environment, as we spent our entire lives in the same small group of people. But we now live in a world in which novel partners, like fat, salt, and sugar, are in unending supply and serve as a constant temptation for us to abandon our current relationship to try out a new and more exciting one. Of course, the new relationship will soon become old, as the allure of novelty is fleeting by definition, and thus eventually unsatisfying. Rather remarkably, that obvious fact doesn't prevent people from being serial monogamists now, just as it didn't prevent our ancestors from adopting a similar mating strategy back in the day. Most people are better at avoiding temptation than resisting it. And sure enough, people who escape the lure of novelty usually achieve this goal by not exposing themselves to it. Marriages last longer in rural areas than in cities, and much longer still if you're a nobody than if you're a famous actor or rock star. And these findings bring us back to the German folk saying about the inevitable disappointment we experience when we achieve our goals. Universal adoration and fame are some of the most common dreams of people all over the world. But you need only reflect on the turbulent lives and repeated divorces of celebrities to realize how much happier you are being unknown. Getting to the good life in 10 easy steps. If anyone who doesn't know you tells you there are 10 easy steps to happiness, you're being taken for a ride. As I've just discussed, not only is there no such thing as lasting happiness, but paths to happiness differ for different people. Nevertheless, approaching happiness from an evolutionary perspective can help us achieve it, at least some of the time, and can also help us understand happiness itself. So, I'm not really offering 10 easy steps here, but in service of these goals, I summarize the lessons of the last two chapters in 10 essential points. 1. Stay present. Our proclivity to live in the future disrupts our ability to enjoy the present, particularly when the present provides unexpected pleasures. If you fail to find happiness in the pleasures of daily life, then a program of mindfulness or meditation might help you. Learning to live in the present might also reduce your stress levels if you tend to worry about the future. Keep in mind, however, that living in the now is a lot more difficult than it sounds, largely because you are trying to shut down one of the most important skills that evolution gave you in your capacity to plan for the future. 2. Seek out sweet moments. It's almost impossible to become permanently happier, but that doesn't mean you can't have more fun in your life. Achieving our evolutionary imperatives brings us positive emotions that range from contentment to great joy. We just need to be prepared for the fact that these feelings won't last. But who wouldn't opt for more frequent happy moments? 3. Guard your happiness to stay healthy. Happiness is critical for physical health. If you are sacrificing your happiness for something that isn't incredibly important, you should ask yourself how long this situation has lasted and how long it's likely to last in the future. Short-term sacrifices can be sensible, but long-term sacrifices should be avoided if at all possible. If you must sacrifice your happiness to achieve your goals, try to prepare a timeline and stick to it. Otherwise, you might wake up one day to find your short-term sacrifice has been going on for years, and your happiness and health are a thing of the past. 4. Accumulate experiences, not stuff. The great times you have become a part of you. The great things you own gather dust or become trash. That said, if your memory for your lived experiences is as bad as mine, you might struggle to recall many of the great times you've had, and then find yourself at risk of owning nothing and remembering little. A simple solution to this problem is to take pictures, and even purchase the occasional doodad from your travels or adventures. By scattering these reminders around your home or office, you can relive your great times and laugh at the adventures that went awry. 5. Prioritize food, friends, and sexual relationships. These three things are the basis of day-to-day happiness. Note that there is no mention here of money or freedom. There's nothing wrong with having lots of cash and autonomy, but their pursuit shouldn't interfere with opportunities to enjoy good food, sex, and friends. These three things are most likely to provide the happy experiences that accumulate into a life worth living. 6. Cooperate. Working together with family, friends, and colleagues to achieve mutual goals is one of the most important sources of life satisfaction. Your achievements won't make you permanently happier, but cooperation is inherently rewarding and provides a foundation for life satisfaction. Happiness doesn't emerge only from leisure and fun, but also from work and productivity, particularly when you are satisfying your evolutionary imperative of cooperating with others. Not all the work we do is meaningful, as life has necessary drudgery, but working with people you trust and admire lightens the load. 7. Embed yourself in community. Give careful thought to any decisions that require you to pull up roots and go somewhere else. We evolved to be curious, so new people and new places are forever enticing, but you don't need to abandon old friends to meet new people and see new places. Even if you have a strong wanderlust, you should try to retain your connections to your community. 8. Learn new things. Learning is a lifelong source of happiness, and play and storytelling are two important sources of learning. At all stages of life, from childhood to young adulthood through to midlife and old age, we enjoy mastering new things. If you choose your activities thoughtfully, you can enjoy the process of learning up to your last healthy days on this earth. 9. Play to your strengths. There are many roads to happiness, but almost all of them are found by pursuing your particular strengths, which are likely to change over time. Change is intimidating for almost everyone, as it requires us to move from the known to the unknown, and hence from the predictable to the unpredictable. For this reason, many people remain too long with jobs or hobbies that once suited them, but do not anymore. Just because you once loved something doesn't mean you are destined to always feel that way. Your changing sources of happiness are probably telling you that your old life doesn't suit you anymore. 10. Seek the original source. Our modern world provides numerous opportunities for happiness that resemble but do not duplicate the original sources. Some are perfectly fine, for example, TV and movies. Some probably do more harm than good, for example, alcohol, drugs, and junk food. But none is as good as the ancestral originals. Time with family and friends sits at the top of our species checklist and is our best recipe for happiness. Epilogue. Evolution is not a warm and fuzzy concept. Whoever leaves behind the most offspring wins, no matter how that goal is achieved. So it's no surprise that the process itself is often brutal. I remember watching a nature show on TV in which a pack of hyenas tore a baby zebra limb from limb without even bothering to kill it first. I felt sick to my stomach, but for the hyenas, it was just an afternoon snack, and I'm sure they gave it no thought once they finished the last tidbit. Animals that arrive at effective solutions to their problems pass on their genes, and with them their solutions, whether they're vicious killers like those hyenas, or adorable vegetarians like the baby zebra they consumed. Indeed, vicious and adorable, good and bad, moral and immoral, all these are human constructs that don't exist in the natural world. Evolution is amoral. Why am I reminding you of this? Because the evolutionary pressures inherent in such a world could easily have brought us to a miserable place. Our chimp cousins rarely look out for one another the way we do, and the same holds true for our baboon second cousins. If you read Robert Sapolsky's wonderful book on savanna baboons, A Primate's Memoir, you'll see that the life of a baboon isn't much fun, unless you're the alpha, with everyone endlessly harassing the monkey below them in the hierarchy. Their solution to the challenges of life on the savanna could just as easily have been our own, but as luck would have it, Australopithecines evolved to protect themselves by working together. Homo erectus then expanded on their ancestors' loose-knit cooperation with division of labor, and the resultant interdependence gave us a life strategy that was not only effective, but kind as well. One of the most disconcerting aspects of evolution is the enormous role played by random chance. Our existence as a species is the result of innumerable rolls of the dice, every one of which had to go our way. The most trivial perturbations in our past would have changed everything. If our parents had felt amorous on a different night, or if other sperm happened to win the race to fertilize our mother's eggs, I wouldn't be writing this, and you wouldn't be reading it. The probability that either of us got a chance to live at all is vanishingly small, and yet, here we are. As Richard Dawkins puts it in his fascinating book, Unweaving the Rainbow, we are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. But the mere fact that we get to live is not what makes us lucky. Many animals live a life that I would just as soon forego, not because it ends in tragedy as it did for that baby zebra, but because their approach to living is one of endless conflict. Imagine being a seagull and spending your entire life fighting other seagulls for scraps. What makes us so lucky is the pure happenstance that we evolved to be mostly good to one another. Our cooperative nature also set the stage for the evolution of our amazing brain. Our sociality made us smarter individually, but far more important, it connected our minds to others' minds in a manner that massively increased our knowledge and computing power. As a result, we long ago surpassed the predators that hunted us on the savannah, and are now holding most of the pathogens at bay that are a much greater threat than predators ever were. For the first time in history, we no longer bury almost half our children before they reach adulthood. Evolution is brutal. But those of us with the good fortune to live in established democracies have used the tools that evolution gave us to create unprecedentedly safe and satisfying lives. We evolved a psychology that continually searches for something better. But a moment's reflection reveals that it's hard to ask for much more than that. This is Michael David Axtell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Social Leap, The New Evolutionary Science of Who We Are, Where We Come From, and What Makes Us Happy, by William von Hippel. Presented by Harper Wave and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Iris McElroy. Text copyright 2018 by William von Hippel. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.